The following podcast is banned in the state of Florida for talking about a dangerous leftist book, the Bible. Like the Bible, this podcast contains frank discussions on sensitive topics, including sex, violence, and cursing. Please proceed with caution. They had absolutely no appetite for food. They had arrived at death's gates. So they cried out to the Lord in their distress, and God saved them from their desperate circumstances. God gave the order and healed them. God rescued them from their pit. Let them thank the Lord for God's faithful love and God's wondrous works for all people. This is the Word in Black and Red.
Hello, and welcome to The Word in Black and Red, where we read the Bible from a leftist and liberationist perspective to elucidate the way people of faith and their comrades can understand the Bible as a source of healing, love, and liberation for all people. I am your host, Michael Belong, the wise old Llama Emby, joined today by the wonderful Demo and Josh from Josh Fights a Bear. Last time Josh was on, I asked, of course, why don't you fight twinks instead? Josh is too busy, of course, these days to be fighting either bears or twinks.
And besides, if you fought twinks, they would break too easily.
That sounds bad. I don't want to do that.
They would snap in half like twigs.
Much love to our twink community. We wouldn't be bears without you. So you can, of course, always join Demo on Tumblr, where I absolutely love their posting. Demo is very sexy is their handle there. And then demo-the-fox.itch.io or itch.io.
Yep, that's right. Where you can find all of my poorly made video games.
They're better than Demo gives them credit for. And then and Josh, of course, can be found on the Ideas About God podcast that I highly recommend. Again, please start from the beginning, especially if some of the things that we talk about on this show sometimes confuse you. Ideas About God is a great way to get into those ideas and understand God from the ground up, I'd say.
And if you, for some reason, decide to follow my blog and you want to hear more of my religious takes, block the furry tag, because otherwise you're just going to get furry with an occasional religious post. Block the furry tag if you want to actually hear what I have to say.
That is a good tip that I have definitely not followed because I'm definitely not a furry. What are you talking about?
Definitely not, Llama NB.
Oh no, people are going to make a llama fursona for me now.
Podcast listeners, you have your homework. You have your homework.
If someone makes a llama fursona for me, I will change at least one of my social media handles to that fursona. So that there is your reward.
There you go.
Today, we're going to be continuing our story about Joseph, where we are going to hear about how his fortunes have changed. Last time, Joseph was left in the prison after having been accused or possibly committing a sexual violence against Potiphar's wife. But here, we will see how his story changes. Of course, a very sympathetic story, but how his fortune changes to from one of absolute bottom of the rung to where he is about to be appointed the leader de facto of Egypt. So, without further ado, we'll dive right on into Genesis 40 through 41. Sometime later, both the wine steward and the baker for Egypt's king offended their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief wine steward and the chief baker, and he put them under arrest with the commander of the royal guard in the same jail where Joseph was imprisoned. The commander of the royal guard assigned Joseph to assist them. After they had been under arrest for some time, both of them, the wine steward and the baker for Egypt's king, who were imprisoned in the jail, had dreams one night, and each man's dream had its own meaning. When Joseph met them in the morning, he saw that they were upset. He asked the officers of Pharaoh who were under arrest with him in his master's house, "Why do you look so distressed today?" They answered, "We've both had dreams, but there's no one to interpret them." Joseph said to them, "Don't interpretations belong to God? Describe your dreams to me." The chief wine steward described his dream to Joseph. "In my dream there was a vine right in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. When it budded, its blossoms appeared, and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, so I took the grapes, crushed them into Pharaoh's cup, and put the cup in Pharaoh's hand." Joseph said to him, "This is the dream's interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. After 3 days, Pharaoh will give you an audience and return you to your position. You will put the Pharaoh's cup in his hands, just the way you were before when you were his wine steward. But please, remember me when you are doing well and be loyal to me. Put in a good word for me to Pharaoh, so he sets me free from this prison. I was stolen from the land of the Hebrews, and here too I've done nothing to be thrown into this dungeon. When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was favorable, he said to Joseph, "It was the same for me. In my dream there were 3 baskets of white bread on my head. In the basket on top there were baked goods for Pharaoh's food, but birds were eating them out of the basket on my head." Joseph responded, "This is the dream's interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. After 3 days, Pharaoh will give you an audience and will hang you from a tree where birds will peck your flesh from you." The 3rd day was Pharaoh's birthday, and he gave a party for all of his servants. Before all of his servants, he gave an audience to the chief wine steward and the chief baker. He returned the chief wine steward to his position, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But the chief baker he hanged, just as Joseph had said would happen when he interpreted their dreams for them. But the chief wine steward didn't remember Joseph. He forgot all about him. 2 years later, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing near the Nile. In front of him, 7 healthy-looking, fattened cows climbed out of the Nile and grazed on the reeds. Just then, 7 other cows, terrible-looking and scrawny, climbed up out of the Nile after them and stood beside them on the bank of the Nile. The terrible-looking, scrawny cows devoured the 7 healthy-looking, fatted cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. He went back to sleep and had a 2nd dream, in which 7 ears of grain, full and healthy, grew on a single stalk. Just then, 7 ears of grain, scrawny and scorched by the east wind, sprouted after them. And the scrawny ears swallowed up the full and well-formed ears. Then Pharaoh woke up and realized it was a dream. In the morning he was disturbed and summoned all of Egypt's religious experts and all of its advisers. Pharaoh described his dreams to them, but they couldn't interpret them for Pharaoh. Then the chief wine steward spoke to Pharaoh. "Today I've just remembered my mistake. Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief baker under arrest with the commander of the royal guard. We both dreamed one night, he and I, and each of our dreams had its own interpretation. A young Hebrew man, a servant of the commander of the royal guard, was with us. He described our dreams to him, and he interpreted our dreams for us, giving us an interpretation for each dream. His interpretations came true exactly. Pharaoh restored me to my position, but hanged him." So Pharaoh summoned Joseph, and they quickly brought him from the dungeon. He shaved, changed clothes, and appeared before Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I had a dream, but no one could interpret it. Then I heard that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It's not me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable response." So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "In my dream I was standing on the bank of the Nile. In front of me, 7 fatted cows climbed up out of the Nile and grazed on the reeds. Just then, 7 other cows, weak and frail and thin, climbed up after them. I've never seen such awful cows in all the land of Egypt. Then the thin, frail cows devoured the 1st 7 fattened cows. But after they had swallowed them whole, no one would have known it. They looked just as bad as they had before. Then I woke up. I went to sleep again and saw in my dream 7 full and healthy ears of grain growing on 1 stalk. Just then, 7 hard and thin ears of grain, scorched by the east wind, sprouted after them. And the thin ears swallowed up the healthy ears. I told the religious experts, but they couldn't explain it to me. Joseph said to Pharaoh, "Pharaoh has actually had 1 dream. God has announced to Pharaoh what God is about to do. The 7 healthy cows are 7 years, and the 7 healthy ears of grain are 7 years. It's actually 1 dream. The 7 thin and frail cows climbing up after them are 7 years. The 7 thin ears of grain scorched by the east wind are 7 years of famine. It's just as I told Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what God is about to do. 7 years of great abundance are now coming through the entire land of Egypt. After them, 7 years of famine will appear, and all of the abundance in the land of Egypt will be forgotten. The famine will devastate the land. No one will remember the abundance in the land, because the famine that follows it will be so severe. The dream occurred to Pharaoh 2 times, because God has determined to do it, and God will make it happen soon. Now Pharaoh should find an intelligent, wise man and give him authority over the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh should appoint administrators over the land and take 1/5 of all the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. During the good years that are coming, They should collect all such food and store the grain under Pharaoh's control, protecting the food in the cities. This food will be reserved for the 7 years of famine to follow in the land of Egypt, so that the land won't be ravaged by the famine. This advice seemed wise to Pharaoh and all his servants, and Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man with more God-given gifts than this one?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made all this known to you, no one is as intelligent and as wise as you are. You will be in charge of my kingdom, and all my people will obey your command. Only as the enthroned king will I be greater than you." Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Know this, I've given you authority over the entire land of Egypt." Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. He dressed him in linen cloths, and he put a gold necklace around his neck. He put Joseph on the chariot of his second in command, and everyone in front of him cried out, "Attention!" So Pharaoh installed him over the entire land of Egypt. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh. No one will do anything or go anywhere in all the land of Egypt without your permission." Pharaoh renamed Joseph Zophanah-Paneah and married him to Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah and the priest of Heliopolis. Then Joseph assumed control of the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he began to serve Pharaoh, Egypt's king, when he left Pharaoh's court and traveled through the entire land of Egypt. During the 7 years of abundance, the land produced plentifully. He collected all of the food during the 7 years of abundance in the land of Egypt and stored the food in cities. In each city, he stored the food from the fields surrounding it. Joseph amassed grain like the sand of the sea. There was so much that he stopped trying to measure it because it was beyond measuring. Before the years of famine arrived, Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of Heliopolis, gave birth to two sons for Joseph. Joseph named the oldest son Manasseh, because he said, "God has helped me forget all of my troubles and everyone in my father's household." He named the second Ephraim, because he said, "God has given me children in the land where I have been treated harshly." The 7 years of abundance in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. The famine struck every country, but the entire land of Egypt had bread. When the famine ravaged the entire land of Egypt and the people pleaded to Pharaoh for bread, Pharaoh said to all of the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph, do whatever he tells you." The famine covered every part of the land, and Joseph opened all of the granaries and sold grain to the Egyptians. In the land of Egypt, the famine became more and more severe. Every country came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because in every country the famine had also become more severe. So in this story, we really see three main movements happening. First, we see this this drama that goes on that's actually in the jail, and we'll be focusing on these three different sections and three different sections of the conversation. This first scene here, where the drama happens within the context of the jail, where Joseph is surrounded by these two other people, that sort of proves Joseph's credentials. And then goes on to talk about Joseph actually interpreting Pharaoh's dreams and all the little things that are happening within Pharaoh's dreams that really strike at the heart of the power of the Egyptian empire at the time. And then it goes to this last section where Joseph goes from the down and out last born son who gets sold off as a slave into slavery and is brought all the way around back to this position of power. And not just any power, but second to Pharaoh himself, and the different roles that that's happening. And I think the amassing of wealth for the kingdom of Egypt that ultimately results in the enslavement of the Hebrew people. But we'll go ahead and start focusing in on that first section.
Joseph's story feels a lot like a Forrest Gump story. Forrest Gump, it's a fine movie. It's boomer. It's boomer bait. It's like if you were born the right time, you like. And the movie, I think, unknowingly tells us this, communicates this. But it's like this guy was just born at the right time and happens to be just a fairly decent, kind human being. Like, there's nothing inherently wrong with Forrest Gump as a person. He's kind and thoughtful. And just through that sheer, he ends up becoming some multimillionaire, crazy wildlife, has all these things, finds his way into all these weird political situations. And it feels like the moral of the story is it's trying to tell you just be a good guy and look at all this good stuff that'll happen to you. And it's just like, no, he just got really lucky. And I feel like that's a story that, certain generations or certain folks want to have told, be told about them. Like whenever you read like these successful CEOs, like write stories about themselves, you're like, oh, like I was just lucky and pluck and determination. And it's like, no, you left out the part where like you started this company with a loan from like your father-in-law or something. Right. Like, I don't know. It just, it's, it kind of feels like myth making.
Joseph just happens to be like, well, I mean, you could say in the wrong place at the wrong time a bunch of times, right? Like he has this terrible luck, gets sold into slavery, gets, you know, just absolutely has the worst luck of anybody, right? If everything that the biblical account tells us happens to Joseph actually happens just to him rather than, you know, in any way is caused by him, then you have this guy who just gets screwed over time and time again. He's trying to do what's right, or he's trying to just do what's neutral, and he ends up getting, you know, sold into slavery and then sold into this house where he does his best and tries to do it and then gets accused of something wrongfully and then gets thrown into jail and then is just trying to do this. And, you know, it seems like he is, you know, Forrest Gump. He just keeps running. He keeps interpreting dreams, even though it has really screwed him over in the past.
Now I'm just going to imagine, like, I just imagining like Forrest Gump in the Technicolor dream coat. Like for some reason, my brain's like putting this together.
Absolutely. Instead of the shit happens bumper sticker, it's a shit happens Technicolor dream code.
Mama was saying you can tell a lot about a person by the way they dream.
A couple of thoughts come to me here. And first, I guess I agree that we should definitely avoid the temptation to read into this as sort of prosperity gospel sort of thing, right? Because I think that's a little bit of an oversimplification. Because especially reading the rest of the scriptures, it's pretty clear that like, the way in which God visits people in their afflictions, the way that God blesses people, the way that it works in the scriptures, it seems to me, is that it depends on the situation. And from our limited point of view, God might appear even, you know, fickle in how he blesses people. The key thing I think we can learn here, no matter what it looks like, is that Joseph finds himself in affliction through no fault of his own, or even if it is his fault, even like, let's assume for a moment that it is true that Joseph in the last chapter did act horribly to Potiphar's wife. Whether Joseph did nothing wrong or because of his own indiscretion, because we could read all in all these things a certain level of willfulness, right? Joseph was an obnoxious kid to his brothers, and so they threw him in a pit, right? Let's be real, he was pretty obnoxious, being like, I'm going to be the best one out of all of you, even if he was right. It's like, come on, dude, really? I had a dream, and it tells me that I'm better than all of you. Like, come on. Come on, man. Like, who wouldn't? Like, who hasn't seriously considered throwing their brother into a pit? Am I right? Whether Joseph got into the troubles that he got into through no fault of his own, or if he acted in such a way where, because of his actions, he was put into trouble, God still visits him in his afflictions. I think that's what matters here. Whatever Joseph did or didn't do, God is still with him through his afflictions. And I think we'll find in the future that what others view as affliction, God views as opportunity. This, you know, this whole story is, I guess, a story of redemption, where Joseph loses everything and then gains everything back and more. I guess the important point is that, you know, like, then this is, I hope it's clear I'm not reading into this as sort of like prosperity gospel. If you just do everything right, God will bless you. Regardless, I think God will bless you. And God will find ways to respond with grace to affliction. And perhaps even have affliction be the site of grace rather than like and something that is opposition to it.
Here we see Joseph sort of falling into the pattern that he keeps finding himself in, which is like he's become the like assistant to the imprisoner of the like he's become the assistant warden basically of his own prisoners. But I think that the big difference between that original story where he is in no way empathetic to his brothers, right? He sees the people who are closest to him and he's like, yeah, I'm going to be the boss of you one day, and completely ignores them. But here we see this really dramatic character arc from like, I am my father's favorite boy, to
becoming the slave, the lowest of the low, working his way back up, and then getting slotted down again. And it's only here, at this lowest of low points, that he seems to gain some empathy for other human beings. He, you know, in verse 6, when Joseph met them in the morning, he saw that they were upset. And this seems to be the only time that he recognizes that another human being is upset, because he was completely obtuse with his brothers, and that got him thrown into a pit. And he was completely obtuse with Potiphar's wife, which got him into that, you know, into that room at the very least, where he was able to compromise, where he compromised himself. And so there is, you know, it's finally this third situation where he's finally able to recognize, oh, these are people who are in need of my help, or I'm going to use my gift to help others. Now, is he helping others with an end to getting out? Is another question. But it seems like he is actually paying attention to what other people are doing and caring about them for the first time in his life.
I think that's a good thing to notice, because certainly at the very beginning, he kind of felt that youngest brother syndrome. I am daddy's specialist little boy. I got the coat and you guys didn't. Neener, neener, right? One thing I find interesting in scripture, a pattern I like noticing, is when characters in scripture start noticing people for the first time, like whenever, I feel like whenever a narrative introduces more people, it's like that the person that we're seeing the world from is noticing them for the first time. Up until this point, the only people that Joseph really interacted with, if we're going to follow your logic, are, you know, his family and, you know, his superiors, right? And the people who were like either punishing him, getting him into trouble, or the people that he lived with. There's never been anyone beneath Joseph that he's paid attention to. Except here. This is the first time, and he's noticing some, like, objectively, these people are beneath him. He is like the prison warden, and these are, you know, people who have been imprisoned, and he is attending to them. So I think it's interesting here how he has gone from serving, but from a position of power, to being in a position of power but serving. Like, in Potiphar's place, he was, you know, the head servant. Everything went through him. It was all about him and how great he was. But here, that dynamic has flipped. And he's still in charge, but he is serving the people beneath him, which I think is something of a Christ-like gesture. I've heard people talk about how Joseph could be, if you're looking at this from a Christian point of view, Joseph could be read as something of a Christ figure, potentially. But I think this is the first place where we can really see that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, and like that Christ-like figure, it comes back to this story that is told of the wine steward, right? That this is the dream's interpretation, that the three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, you will be restored, right? He goes, the wine steward goes from this position as basically a dead man to back to life. And in that way is said by some of the early fathers to prefigure the return of Christ, and that this story of Joseph similarly refigures the return of Christ. Now, I'm going to push back on that a little bit more as we get into the third section of the discussion, but I you're absolutely onto something here, that there is this connection here with biblical numerology that, you know, I keep referencing and don't get into all that much because you can very easily get it wrong. So we have this three here in this story as a symbol of redemption. In Jonah, it is 3 days in the belly of a whale, right, where he goes down to the deepest depths and then comes out of that. And again, in Joseph, in the story of Jesus, we have this redemption over the course of 3 days. And so this number three is something that keeps popping out at us as the source of redemptive change. And if you are a Trinitarian, you also believe that the three members of the Trinity are three people, right? And so I just like to throw that out there as a Christian leftist to think about the ways in which God is the agent of redemptive change, the Godhead being the source of that change ultimately. this is what we do in interpretation. We get to play around with these things, and we get to see what are the things that, where are we seeing these connections, right? Where are we seeing these things that are tying together? And that leads us into the interpretation of Pharaoh's dreams, right? So speaking of that numerology, that here we see seven healthy cows and seven scrawny cows, right? We see seven good forms of grain and seven bad forms of grain. Yeah, so this numerology that is connected here are the seven grains and the seven cows, right? And then the seven that come after them. And seven, of course, in biblical numerology is again this symbol of completeness, right? It's like the end has been completed. It's kind of like 40, where 40 just represents a really long time or a generation. And 70 is like a big group of people. Like 40 is a long time, 70 is a big group of people, seven is complete, right? And so, and we see that seven is actually like a symbol a lot of the time in lots of different things. The seven hills of Rome, for example.
Does that come from the Genesis story where God rests on the seventh day?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so it is seven is the sign of completeness in the week, right? That orients our understanding of time. That is a complete unit, and then you move on to the next one. You know, whether or not it's exactly 7 years, and then 7 years is really not as important as saying there will be a complete time that this is, and then there will be a complete time in which this is. And so, but it is interesting that this seven number is specifically used, this perfection number, as if it is God's plan brought to perfection, that the people of Egypt are only able to survive because of what Joseph is able to offer here in this interpretation.
The dream is very simple, right? It's like, oh, the dream is like, oh, we're going to have this complete time of plenty. And then after that, we're going to have a complete time of famine and drought. And that's like, okay, so that's the information from the dream. All of this extra stuff that comes along about Joseph being like, okay, well, now you need a leader, and you need someone to like a quartermaster kind of person, like organize this thing. Like that's all like, that's not actually part of the interpretation. That's like something else. And I wonder like what God was up to. I don't think God works like that really, but what are they trying to say about, I wonder what the authors are trying to say about God's will or purpose in this. Like did God want Joseph to become the number two guy in Egypt? Or was this some sort of a test or a, like Joseph just could have been like, all right, here's the interpretation. Do with that what you will. You know,
Pharaoh describes his dreams to them, but they couldn't interpret them for Pharaoh, right? Well, like, presumably if you are hired to be the religious expert who is a dream interpreter, you could make something up. This does not seem like you're stumping for anything. Like, you know, in the same sort of story that happens in the book of Daniel, right? So first off, sorry, let's step back. This is a court drama, right? And I don't mean a dun-dun court drama. I mean an actual court, like a royal court drama. And there are a number of these throughout the biblical narrative. Joseph in the court of the Pharaoh, Daniel in the court of Nebuchadnezzar, and Esther in the court of King Ahasuerus. And so, like, these different court dramas are playing out in different ways, but one of the typecasts that we see here is that the king is kind of clueless. Like, the king is first off, the king doesn't have much character to them. King Ahasuerus is named, Nebuchadnezzar is named, but other than that, they don't really have a personality. Like, this pharaoh is just, like, generically pharaoh, doesn't get a name, because they're not real, right? They're just playing this sort of position where our hero is able to come in and be the hero against the backdrop of these sort of senseless kings who are wandering around. But Nebuchadnezzar is at least clever enough to say, hey, I hire a bunch of these magicians to be able to do these things for me. So I'm not going to tell you the dream and have you interpret it for me. You're going to tell me the dream and interpret it for me. And if you're right, then I know you're actually telling the truth. Whereas Pharaoh is kind of dumb and it's just like, I'll tell you the thing. And then his magicians aren't able to come up with anything. Like, these are smart dudes. In the book of Exodus, they figure out ways to replicate all the miracles that God is committing to show the power of God, right? And that might be showcasing the fact that the authors of this text actually believed that there were power to the gods of Egypt. But in this text, it doesn't seem like the gods of Egypt are even acknowledged, that there are any gods of Egypt. It just seems like Joseph is like, yeah, God is the one who's doing these things. And everyone's like, oh yeah, this God I've never heard of, that's the God who's doing it, right? And and so they just seem to go along with Joseph's monotheism that they certainly didn't accept as a culture.
I'm beginning to suspect that this story was tampered a little bit by people who were trying to double down a little bit on the monotheism of the temple period. I have a sneaking suspicion.
You're saying this wasn't written down exactly as it happened, Dima?
Well, listen. I'm not saying that.
I think the Bible's saying that.
I really like verse 14, where Pharaoh calls Joseph in, and the first thing we get about that is, Then Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was hurriedly brought out of the dungeon. When he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came before Pharaoh. It's like, he's getting ready for a job interview here, you know? Just gotta get into your Sunday best, shave up, make sure you don't look too scruffy. There's something about that, I don't know, just feels very human to me. Just the fact that we decided to linger on that little detail that Joseph got shaved up and dressed up before going into Pharaoh. And then, of course, later on, in the same vein, that Joseph is like, now Pharaoh should find an intelligent, wise man and give him authority over the land of Egypt. Come on, man. I don't know, I just think it's very funny. Joseph certainly falls into the sort of trickster archetype in the Bible. You know, he's there with, like, Jacob in terms of, like, the trickster. The hero trickster, for sure. Not a ruthless trickster by any means, but certainly a trickster nonetheless. I do think it's interesting too. The most trickstery thing that Joseph does isn't going to happen for a little bit yet, right? Down the line, we're going to get the story of how Joseph reunites with his whole family, and he certainly leans very hard into the trickster archetype there. But certainly the thing that Joseph is above all other things that we see him for in the, like, His overriding character trait, for better and worse, is that he's very cunning, right? He is very good at taking advantage of his situation. You know, like, whether he's, you know, doing that for good or evil is a discussion for another time. Most people, I'm pretty sure, would argue that he's doing it for good, but it sounds like there may be some convincing interpretations that he wasn't always using that power for the best ends. But if nothing else, Joseph is a very, very cunning character. He's very savvy. He's very good at taking advantage of situations and very good at, like, kind of using his connections to give him power and opportunity. Whether or not, like, the court magicians either had nothing to say to Pharaoh or just didn't give him satisfactory answers, Joseph, if nothing else, is very good at, you know, he's very good at managing social relations, and very rarely does he get the bottom. Well, actually, he quite often gets the bottom hand, but I think this story of Joseph is him learning how best to navigate things to come out on top. Certainly we can learn from that, as, you know, Jesus himself said, you should be gentle as doves and cunning as vipers.
In verse 16, you know, I don't know how to read this, because is it actually humility? Or is it this faux cunning where Joseph answered Pharaoh, it's not me, God will give Pharaoh a favorable response? Is it really that Joseph just believes so fully in God's power to be able to interpret this? Or is he trying to say that I worship a God so powerful that God can do this, and God is the one who's doing all these sort of things, and so that's what God is telling me? Or is he just manipulating things? Like, is he just being smarter than the other court magicians and saying, well, you know, I'm attributing this to God, so you can really trust it, because it's not my interpretation. It's God who's doing it for me.
That's a good question. And I guess my answer is probably both. Probably both, because I do think one thing that we find again and again, that I do think that Joseph has a very deep connection with God. Like, for example, down the line, we find out that he named his kids like Manasseh and Ephraim in response to the way that he felt that God had treated him kindly in his affliction. You know, I think really you could say he's doing both at the same time, because he knows that this is from God. But he also knows that God is the one, at least he believes that God is the one giving him this opportunity. You know, who's he to say no to God, right? God is just handing him this job opportunity on a plate. Like, yeah, yes, he knows that God is like, give the glory to God and all that. But, you know, God's giving him, you know, this cushy job for Pharaoh. You know, you gotta take opportunities when God gives them to you, right? You know, I do think that Joseph has a very deep, like, connection with God. And I don't think that's disingenuous. I don't think that's like disingenuous by any means, but I do think that he's a sly guy. He's a sly guy. He takes advantage of things, and he's not afraid to do that. So that's my 2 cents, I guess.
All right, Josh, get in on this. Is Joseph just Tim Tebowing? Is he just like doing it to get the attention so that he can sell a book afterwards that sells out to conservative audiences?
There's a part of me that wants to read it in that cynical way, right? That wants to be like, oh yeah, it's just a story. Like, he's like, this is all kind of like, Joseph wants to be portrayed in this way. And so like this whole thing is his way of like, is right. His own like myth making, in a sense. And like, that's the thing about myth making, is like, we can cover up like the ugly parts. And so with this, it's like, oh yeah, it's not me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable response. And it's like, there's a cynical part of me that wants to be like, oh yeah, like he's saying that, but it's also at the time, like he's also, he doesn't believe it. And also like, maybe he's just human, you know, like I had that thought, like when when you made that comment where, the first thing he does is he cleans up and gets dressed. Cause like, it is a job interview. And like if someone, like if I'm in a rough spot and I get a shot at like, you know, some job that like, it's going to help me out, like, I'm probably going to sell myself a little bit, you know, like I don't got to respect the hustle, I guess, do what you got to do. So like, yeah, so it's also human.
I really like that idea of like the hustle. I know the way that the hustle is often employed in our world is very like, you know, capitalistic, got to get on your Sigma male grind set sort of thing, you know, that blah, 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 right? Like insert eye roll here. But I think if you look at this in the context of the world in which Joseph lives, you know, it kind of makes sense. You know, Joseph lives in a world of the rulers and the ruled. He lives in a world of the conquerors and the conquered. That's the world of the Bible. The entire Bible resides firmly in this very winner-take-all mindset. You know, and that's arguably the world we still live in today. Just the particulars of who the winners are have changed. Instead of kings, it's capitalists. Instead of empires, it's the IMF. And things like that, you know. But I think it's key to note that Joseph's actions make sense within that context. He's, you know, trying to make the best of his situation in a world that is, you know, very unkind. And like he's only human. He lives within his context, you know. Very rarely are you going to see someone who truly tries to push for something new, like Christ or something like that, right? Christ, his interaction with Pilate is very telling, I think. I'm going way ahead. This is one of my favorite instances in all of the scriptures, is just seeing the ways in which Christ's world is so alien to everybody around him and the world they live in. But, you know, Joseph does live in this world of the rulers and the ruled, and he is going to play the game. And he's good at the game. I don't think he's wrong necessarily to play that game, because I don't think he's the worst person to play that game. I think there's other people who play the game a lot worse than he does, but he at least doesn't hurt people and how he plays the game, at least not intentionally.
I hear what you're saying there, demo with the fact that this world is very much so like a winner take all sort of world. That's the way the things have been set up in this ancient time. But I think that what the beauty of the scripture so often is that it's resisting that narrative, right? That is a concept of scarcity, whereas the Bible so often emphasizes abundance, right? Where Joseph is coming from this place of scarcity, of like being at the very bottom, of having been sold into slavery and then accused of this crime and ended up in prison again. And he's coming out of this very much so from a position of scarcity. And I think that you're absolutely right to say that he is playing this game in a dog-eat-dog's world where he's going to take advantage of the situation and able to escape it. But I think that the beauty of the scripture is so often that there is a 7-year cycle throughout the Bible, and that 7-year cycle is supposed to be a 7-year cycle in which debts are forgiven at the end of that 7-year cycle, right? So that no one would be in debt in the end of that 2nd-year cycle. That's a system that's set up by the people of the Bible because they have been so oppressed by this winner-take-all system that we say, no, we don't do winner-take-all. We do what's just and what's fair. And I think that was an option for Joseph here. But to go into this third section here, I think that's not the option that Joseph chooses. That, Joseph says, give me appoint an intelligent wise man and give him authority over the land of Egypt. Now, if he had actually been given the legitimate authority that he was supposed to be given, he could go to all the communities in Egypt and say, hey, y'all, you're going to have this giant famine, right? Collect the food for yourself that you're going to need so that you can distribute it freely among the people after that's done, right? But instead of doing that, he collects it under the power of the Pharaoh. And there's a really strong argument to be said that the administration of Pharaoh was often solidified through these sorts of famines. So famines were not an uncommon thing in the ancient Near East, right? The famines happen all the time. There's not enough water one year. In a drought, you can absolutely devastate a population just by one year of drought, right? And so it would often be that people would save up a little bit, that people would save up enough to try and survive through the next sort of period, right? In Europe, our ancestors survived the winters by saving up enough potatoes so that they would have something indoors when there wasn't any other time to grow things, right? All these sort of things were sort of how we planned out our lives. But when Joseph is taking 20%, taking a fifth of all the produce, that means that people are suddenly not able to save up enough for themselves. They're not able to keep what they have in abundance, and instead they have to give it to Pharaoh, who is then going to sell it back to them when they have no income to be able to buy it. And so the consolidation of power is this sort of thing, is that pharaohs were often ruling not by the threat of imperial might, but precisely through the control of the produce. How much produce was able to get out and be distributed to all of the people is how pharaohs and rulers often kept people in line when they didn't have the sort of giant armies that a Rome or a Babylon were able to constantly keep out and moving around.
I hear what you're saying. And as an anarchist, I'm almost like, hell yeah. On the one hand, I'm like, yes, like I would agree. Like, I can't blame Joseph for not being an anarchist. I mean, I want him to be. I want everyone to join the sweet, sweet embrace of a non-hierarchical organizing.
No gods, no masters.
Breach, right? But like when people don't like engage in that, like I don't, like I'm like, I want them to do better, but also I'm like, oh, like it's kind of goes back to what Dimon was saying, like, oh, like this was how you did the thing back then. And maybe Joseph going out to like form like, you know, workers co-ops, you know, like that's,
or even just a welfare state, you know.
But also at the same time, like we have like I don't know if you guys have got a chance to read David Graeber's book Dawn of Everything. Like it's long, but it's delightful. It's so good. I listened to the audiobook, is great. And his main thesis was that humans, we found there's this traditional idea that human growth and human development, like through as like civilizations gone through, start with like humans living in like non-hierarchical, like unorganized small groups. But after a certain point, usually once you hit like agriculture, inherently hierarchy and authority develops. And so basically his idea was that human society will always progress towards like the British Empire. That's like the scope of history, right? But like David Graeber's point was that humans have had many different ways of organizing ourselves. Like archaeology is showing us all these different ways that human societies have built, and sometimes they were hierarchical, sometimes they weren't. Like there was like the amount of human freedom and autonomy and versus and community versus like independence, like that's like those like sliders have gone back and forth all over the place. What's the question that he's trying to ask is, how did we get stuck in the way we currently see ourselves, where this idea of authority and hierarchy has like taken over everything, where we don't have the freedom? Because like he describes their communities like in Native America, and I'm gonna blank on what it is, but there would be like these big building projects where you'd come together, all these clans and groups would come together and build this huge monument. And in that time, there would be a leader. And then they would have like, they'd be directing things and, you know, kind of leading that stuff. And then once the thing was over, either like the site was built or whatever happened, like the people would disperse and they'd go back. And this person had like no authority. And they're like, what are you going to do? Like, he'd be like, oh, hey, I want you to do this thing. And they'd be like, yeah, get fucked, bud. Like, you have no power here. Like go away. Like, so yeah, on the other hand, maybe we can criticize Joseph, because maybe like humans have always had wide ways of there were maybe there were anarchists in Pharaoh's time. Maybe they didn't call themselves anarchists, but there was someone who's like, yeah, Pharaoh sucks. We shouldn't have him.
And on that note of, you know, people giving up power willingly, interestingly enough, the term dictator actually comes from ancient Rome. Like, not our modern sense of the dictator at all. The original sense of dictator was, you know, in times of trouble, the original Roman Republic, which was, you know, not a democratic republic by any means, but, you know, a republic, which is better than a, you know, an autocracy or something like that. The republic would choose a guy, it would elect a guy, and he would be in charge for 2 years. And then during the war, once the war was over, he would step down and then go back to a republic. And that worked all the way up until Caesar.
And the reason that we use dictator now is precisely because Caesar was the dictator and he never gave it up. And and that is often how leaders in countries do that today, where they begin as, you know, as someone that we've actually chosen, or at least marginally or presumably chosen, and then they just stay in power and stay in power. Josh, I really appreciate your point, because like this was an option, right? Joseph had options. In the mythos of this story, right, this story is probably actually being written much after the Egyptians have been doing this for generations, right, and for centuries. And so presumably, but in the mythos of the story, this seems to be the first time that this is happening. None of Pharaoh's religious experts could see this happening. Presumably it hasn't happened before. And so they don't know what to do. They have no idea what to do, rather than having a robust infrastructure for what they would do in these circumstances and not needing some random presumed criminal to be able to solve this problem for them, right? And so this is, you know, according to the logic of the story, the first time this is happening, and Joseph had options. And rather than choosing to do something where he empowered the people to take care of themselves and get themselves through these 7 years, he instead collapsed power. He collective power. He stretched out the Pharaoh's arms and gathered it all in for Pharaoh. And that sort of direct control of the people that he instilled is the reason why the Hebrew people eventually were enslaved, because the Pharaoh suddenly has all of this economic ability. The Pharaoh can enslave as many people as he wants economically, because, you know, you don't have any money during this famine, so how are you supposed to pay for it? You sell yourself into slavery to me, and then I'm going to build pyramids with you, right? And all these other things. And so the logic of the story is that Joseph essentially gives the power to Pharaoh to enslave all of Joseph's descendants and all of his family because he has gathered up this sort of power. And so, you know, back to Demo's point on the prosperity gospel, you might get wealthy, right, in your lifetime because of what you're willing to do to screw over the other people around you, right? You might get wealthy and you might think, oh, look at how blessed I am, right, for all of these sorts of things. But then look at the way that you are affecting all the people around you, all the people who come after you, right? If not your children are the ones who are affected, then it's millions of other people's children who are affected by this grasp for power, by this desire to have wealth and power. You know, even if you came out of these terrible circumstances, Joseph doesn't seem to be remembering his fellow prisoner after he's in prison, right? He is just like the steward who forgot him for 2 years, and it's only by God's good grace that the steward happened to remember in this circumstance. Joseph doesn't seem to remember the little guy that he had left behind, and in so doing, ends up creating the situation that causes the oppression of his own people for 400 years.
I would like to make a quick amendment to my previous statement in regarding me not blaming Joseph for hustling and having his grind mindset and stuff like that. I think I can blame him a little bit, actually. You've made a very convincing case, and I think I can blame him a little bit here. I stand by what I said about, you know, him living in a world of the rulers in the world and the ruled, but, you know, he wanted to be the ruler. He didn't want to overturn the system that had oppressed him. He wanted to control it and, you know, put himself into a position of power. And I think you're right in that regard. I guess what I mean is, like, I don't blame people in general for, like, you know, playing the game to the extent that you have to play the game. But I feel like once you get to find yourself in a position of power, here's my take. If you find yourself in a position of power, it is your duty to try to overturn that power in some way, right? I think Joseph really missed the opportunity here to do that, to make it so that, you know, he didn't have to go through all that. Because I imagine, you know, I can imagine someone like Joseph being like, oh, you know, we live in a world of opportunity. Even a slave can become the second hand man to the Pharaoh, right? Like, I can imagine. Like, but let's be real. How often does that happen?
And how many more people became slaves because that one slave became the right hand man to Pharaoh, right? And here's the thing that is the most twisted about this story. What if taking 20% of the harvest every year is what caused the famine? Just as a friendly reminder, before I piss off all the tankies, that if we believe in scientific socialism, we have to acknowledge that there is data that conflicts with our conceptions of our economic model. And part of that is that this guy Lysenko didn't believe in evolution because he thought that it was, you know, that it was quote unquote survival of the fittest. Now, of course, we know now that evolution is not survival of the fittest. It is the fact that evolution occurs and helps us survive in particular niches, right? And so it isn't like, you know, the strongest guy is always the one that survives. It's in some species that the strongest guy survives. And also the guy who can go and look like a female of his species so that he can mate with the females who actually like him because he's smarter than the strong guy that they're using to protect them from predators. You know, like all of those little niches that happen in evolution. Anyway, that doesn't say that the strongest survive, right? And that Nietzsche is right and all those things.
Fitness, evolutionarily speaking, does not mean fitness in the capitalist or the fascist sense of strength. I doubt even Nietzsche believed in strength in the way that we like to think Nietzsche believed in strength.
So Lysenko basically goes out and spreads all these nonsense beliefs about how crops grow, right? And in so doing, causes widespread famines in the Soviet Union and in communist China that I think ultimately results in the fall of the Soviet Union several generations later. Like the fact that we were so ideologically motivated to obey his science or listen to his science that was based on absolutely nothing in comparison to the legitimate use of science resulted in the downfall of these countries, right? And not to mention countless atrocities, like millions of people dying, right? But in those circumstances, we saw basically people trying to grow the plants in these ways in such a way that convinced the leader when they drove through that they were actually growing these things in this way, right? That the field was so thick that you could stand on top of it. And like they brought in all the rice from all the remaining fields around there to create this bed so that it looked like a farmer was standing on top of this bed of rice to wave at the dear leader while all the other fields were failing. And so they were just convinced that this science absolutely worked. And that caused the famine that resulted in all these sort of things. And similarly in Ireland, right? Ireland had plenty of food. They were producing food, and then it was all being taken by the British, and they were left only with potatoes to survive. When the Great Potato Famine happened, the problem was not that there was not enough food in Ireland. There was plenty of food in Ireland. The problem was that they wouldn't sell the food back to Irish people at an affordable rate, despite the Irish people being the ones to raise it. And so hundreds of people, millions of people died because of the Great Potato Famine, because of this capitalist enterprise. Same thing happened in India, right? Like this is a common feature that oftentimes governments intervening and affecting the way that things are actually growing and naturally growing, overtaxing the people, all those sort of things, results in famines, results in the suffering of all the people, rather than just allowing them to grow things the way that they have traditionally grown them. So, you know, it's possible that this 20% tax saying, give us 20% of everything you have, and then the next year saying, give us 20% of everything you have, resulted in people overplanting, in which case perhaps they wasted their seed, perhaps they saved too much the previous year and they wasted it that year, or perhaps they extended the land to its full fertility and it wasn't going to grow anything after that, or perhaps people just hid away with little they had, or all sorts of things that could have meant that this famine was not actually inevitable, but after these 7 years, that famine happened because Joseph was collecting all the grain, because he was taking so much grain away from other people. They couldn't grow enough for themselves, and so had to rely on the Pharaoh, and in this way, completely handed over power to the Egyptian authorities.
I think that's a very real possibility. It certainly goes to show exactly the power, the problems of centralizing power too much, like, or at all, perhaps. It certainly goes to show the dangers of that. I do think one thing I'd like to emphasize, bringing God back into it briefly, is just, I think it's important to note that throughout all of this, God still makes all of this work for, you know, towards his ends. I think that's something important to remember. Like, God uses this famine, whether it's caused by Joseph, whether Joseph did the wrong thing and missed an opportunity to make the world more just, God will always respond to injustice with justice. He will always respond to our lack with his abundance. And, you know, Joseph, whether or not he caused this famine, whether or not he, you know, helped set the scene for all the oppression that would come afterwards, you know, Joseph is reunited with his family. He has, you know, a family of his own. And in time, you know, the Hebrew people are led out from, you know, from Egypt. And I think that's the key takeaway here, is that even if we fail, even if we perpetuate systems of abuse rather than ending them, God will always intervene. God always, like, God never responds with what is deserved, with what is owed. He always responds with what is needed. And I think that's the key takeaway here. However Joseph failed, God responded with love. I think that's something we can kind of take as we continue to explore all the many ways in which Joseph ruined everything for everybody forever. The end.
So we're kind of at the end of, like, Joseph comes at the end of, like, a multiple generations of kind of shady dudes. Like Abraham was kind of a shady dude. All these guys lied and were conniving and duplicitous and kind of bastards, and they all kind of worked out for it. And Joseph, and kind of going off of what you said, is like the fourth evolution of this, right? He's taken this kind of conniving to its final form and allied himself with power. That seems bad. That seems like, I wonder like the cinematic moment of this is like, as we see like Joseph ascending to like the heights of Pharaoh being up there, contrasting that with like the beginning of, here's just an old man in the desert who God said was going to create this nation. Like, how did we get here? And it's through a lot of trickery and being duplicitous. And it leads to the creation of the ability to enslave your people in the future. I don't know. I just find that arc is interesting. And I think it's a really interesting way to think about this story.
I really want to see that moment where like Moses is standing there, like having just murdered the Egyptian, and the camera zooms in and it goes, "You're probably wondering how we got here. Well, it all started when this bastard named Joseph." I absolutely love both of those points, that like God still shows up in all of this, right? And if my anarchist reading of this is totally wrong, right? That it's just a very simple story, and it just happens to be that after the Hebrew people move here, they all end up enslaved. You know, that God shows up here, and that God is very here in Providence on purpose, setting all this up so that Joseph can be successful. But I think that the story of God is one that requires this larger context in so many ways, right? You can point to a couple of specific verses and come away with that saying that, you know, God hates people because of who they love. But if you look at the whole course of Scripture and see all the queer people in Scripture, from Isaac to Ruth and Naomi to David and Jonathan to the centurion and his boyfriend, you know, you see, to the Ethiopian eunuch, right? You see all of these people who show up as very queer in the story. And that context is needed so that you don't have that bad reading of the story, right? And I think in this story, we see, and I think throughout Genesis, we have seen that as people accumulate wealth, it divides families, right? It causes suffering for those families. Abraham and Lot can't deal with the fact that they have so much wealth that it's literally destroying the land. And so Abraham and Lot have to separate. Lot ends up in Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah get destroyed. Lot loses his wife and then ends up having bastard sons with his daughters, right? That's pretty fucked up. with Jacob and Esau, they end up getting divided because they both have so much wealth that that the land literally cannot sustain both of them, and their descendants end up hating each other so much that there's a whole book of the Bible that's dedicated to how terrible Esau's descendants are to the descendants of Israel, to Jacob. Those sort of conflicts happen because of this desire for wealth, this desire for monetary gain that divides families. And I think here in this story, we see the same sort of thing happening, that if we just read this story as just Joseph's story in isolation, we see this sort of story of prosperity gospel, where, look, you know, God, it all worked out for Joseph. God made everything work for Joseph. But because Joseph was not concerned about loving his neighbor first, because Joseph was not concerned about taking care of the people first, but was more concerned about accumulating power, about ensuring that his boss got the highest return on investment, of ensuring that his power was maintained for the longest possible time, that resulted in Joseph allowing that same power to enslave his own people. And I think that, to me, is the ultimate takeaway of this story, that even though God will work all things together for good, that we can really get in the way. And even if what we look, what looks to be good on the front page, right, if we aren't taking care of it and ensuring that it is actually caring for our neighbor first, it can end up being a source of oppression to our neighbor as well. And in turn, a source of oppression to us as well. Because, as I hearken on here so often, the source of oppression for my neighbor is ultimately a source of oppression to me as well. Because I cannot be fully human if I don't love everyone else as fully human as well.
Really briefly, I want to talk about, I want to kind of flex my Mormon credentials here, because we love talking about this very thing that you're talking about. I'm going to talk briefly about the Book of Mormon, just very briefly. In the Book of Mormon, there's this thing, this cycle, this phenomena that we like to call the pride cycle, which I think is a misnomer, because it focuses on pride when the actual thing that is being described, the ultimate source of all conflict in the Book of Mormon, is class warfare. It is the very thing that you're talking about. In the Book of Mormon, throughout the entire thing, it goes like this. God grants his people prosperity. God's people start getting proud about it and start, you know, dividing themselves into classes. And the rich people start looking down on the poor people and oppressing them. Wickedness ensues and the people suffer. The people turn to God and to deliver them from their suffering, God intervenes and, you know, et cetera, and so on and so forth. It's very tempting to read this as sort of that whole, like, fascist great man sort of thing. But the key thing here is that it's always the rich people. It's always the rich people oppressing the poor people that causes all the problems. Whenever the rich people get into power, it always causes problems. And it ultimately is the thing. Class division, like, by name, is the thing that causes every single calamity in the Book of Mormon, up into including the final genocide that ends the Book of Mormon.
And you can say that for most of the Bible as well.
The Book of Mormon is just a little more explicit. And it at one point says that the source of all the problem is, and I'm quoting here, dividing into classes, one against another.
Unexpectedly woke.
I know, right? I know. This is why I'm so mad that Mormons are so conservative, because if you read the Book of Mormon, like, for the most part, it's pretty based, actually. It's kind of ridiculous. I'll never get over this. I'll never get over how conservative Mormons are, despite how cool the Book of Mormon is. I will never shut up about this. But I think that's key, is, you know, we're like, our obsession with power is the thing that gets in the way of God and what he wants to do for his people. I think you're right that, you know, the only thing that can really step in and intervene in this process is God. And the only thing that can make it stick is us deciding that we want to work with God rather than being prideful and fighting against him and dividing ourselves into classes and putting ourselves at odds with each other. You know, I think that is the key to, you know, us creating a society that God wants us to.
Well, Demo, you've almost convinced me to read the Book of Mormon. My canon has enough nonsense, but I don't need to add anything else to the canon.
Listen, the reasons Mormons are like that is because we decided to add a whole bunch of our own weirdness to the canon. So I think at the end of the day, everything we've said here is meaningless. Because the VeggieTale version of Joseph, Little Joe, exists, and that's the only version that you'll ever need. Go watch Little Joe. It's pretty good. The Ballad of Little Joe.
Yeah, that's true. We need to that needs to become canon in Bible.
All of our anarchist, super woke, progressive, left leaning ramblings mean nothing because the Ballad of Little Joe exists, and we've all just been put to shame. I'm so sorry. Anarchism has been defeated forever.
Thank you, Demo and Josh, for a wonderful podcast. I just so appreciate talking to y'all both. And thank you to everyone who's listened through my long rantings about this. I think that the Joseph story is one of the central stories that tells us that God is an anarchist. And this is one of the central things that radicalized me and made me realize that the accumulation of power is ultimately something that brings about destruction. And the only way that we'll bring around true liberation for one another is by rejecting that accumulation of power and loving our neighbors first. So thank you all for being a part of it. I so appreciate it. Now, Past Micah, take it away.
Thank you, Future Micah. And of course, you, our wonderful listener. Together, we have made a wonderful and growing community on Discord that I look forward to being a part of every day. Your generous support on Patreon has already greatly increased the quality of our podcast, including this very outro. As an extra little thank you, you can get episodes early along with a bunch of other cool perks. Please follow the link in the show notes to join our Discord, Patreon, and all of the other things mentioned throughout this episode. If you would like to reach me directly, you can reach me through the Discord or by email at thewordinblackandred@gmail.com. Now, Future Micah, say the profound shit.
And thank you, Past Micah. Now go, and reject the accumulation of powers offered by the pharaohs of this world, and choose instead to give the grain to those who need it, so that together we can survive the famines that will come. Shalom. Hey, Josh, how do you know that Joseph played tennis?
How?
Because he served in the courts of Pharaoh.
God. Loving a dad joke.
That's so bad. That's so bad.